This is Inform Your Resistance with Political Research Associates, or PRA. Tune in monthly to hear experts, researchers, journalists, academics, and movement strategists explain some of the most significant contemporary threats to democracy from the mainstream and far right. With Inform Your Resistance, we distill what you need to know most. I'm your host, Cokie Mendes, Communications Director here at PRA. Hello, IYR listeners. We are excited to announce a new 6-part Political Research Associates miniseries produced in partnership with Diaspora Alliance on the weaponization of antisemitism in today's United States. Lifting the Curtain on Antisemitism, hosted by PRA Senior Research Analyst Ben Lorber and Diaspora Alliance's Director of Pedagogy and Training, Shoshana Brown, explores the ways that antisemitism has become an essential tool of the U.S. far right and the Trump administration. Ben and Shoshana talk to experts who help us investigate antisemitism and its weaponization from various angles, from unpacking conspiracy theories to examining the conflation between antisemitism and criticism of Israel, to exploring how to confront antisemitism as left organizers. We hope to give you the tools to navigate current debates, understand the threats we face in our climate of rising authoritarianism, and inform your resistance from the U.S. to Israel, Palestine, and around the world. Subscribe today to our PRA Presents feed, available on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and wherever you get your podcasts. There, you'll find our first 6-part miniseries, The Insurgent Sheriffs, produced in partnership with Quintero Productions, exploring the way that U.S. sheriffs have become an essential part of the far right. And episodes of Lifting the Curtain will be delivered directly to you on that feed when the miniseries launches later this summer. And now on to our regular programming. Thanks for listening. On May 7th, 2025, Political Research Associates hosted a panel discussion with several of our research analysts to highlight specific authoritarian gains made in the first 100 days of President Trump's second term. Our panelists provided key pieces of analysis to help us understand how the individual policy pursuits of this administration underpin this ongoing siege on democracy, and how our movement organizers can strategize effectively across sectors and issue areas to resist the administration and keep each other safe. The webinar titled The First 100 Days of Authoritarian Gains, Key Analysis to Inform Our Resistance, featured PRA Principal Research Advisor Stephen Gardner, Senior Research Analyst Ethan Foray, and an additional PRA Research Analyst who has been anonymized in this podcast episode. The webinar was moderated by our Director of Strategic Partnerships, Reverend Naomi Washington Leapart, and introduced by PRA's new Executive Director, Sylvia Brody. Our panelists provide an overview of the quality makeup and ideologies of the current Trump administration, the interplay between state repression, particularly of the Palestinian Liberation Movement, and Islamophobia and weaponized antisemitism, and the expansion of the deportation machine in direct alignment with the white nationalist anti-immigration movement. A wide-ranging conversation, this panel discussion is the first of two webinars that break down what you need to know most about Trump's first 100 days in office and the strategies needed to resist authoritarian takeover. As a note, because one of our panelists' identity is not being broadcast at this time, you will hear a gentle beeping sound at a few moments in this webinar to help protect her anonymity during this period of heightened state repression. We thank you for your understanding. Enjoy today's episode and stay tuned next month for the second and final part of this first 100 days webinar series, exploring the relationship between gender and authoritarianism.
Hello and welcome to PRA's webinar on the first 100 days of authoritarian gains, key analysis to inform our resistance. I'm Sylvia Brody. I use she, her pronouns, and I am the new executive director of Political Research Associates, also known as PRA. I want to introduce myself and PRA and share some big picture framing for today's webinar. And then our moderator, PRA Strategic Partnerships Director, Reverend Naomi Washington Leapart, will introduce three members of PRA's research team, our speakers for today. I joined the PRA team last fall in the weeks leading up to the election. My background is in community organizing and social movement work. I spent 2 decades helping community groups confront corporate polluters and build collective power for solutions, including 10 years as executive director of an environmental health and justice organization. As a community organizer, I know how important strategy is for crafting winning campaigns and building durable movements for change. Having witnessed the growing power of right-wing and supremacist movements over the past decade, especially in southern states, I was motivated to work for an organization that is building long-term strategy and power on the left. And that brought me to PRA. PRA is a social justice think tank and movement strategy center that researches and exposes right-wing and authoritarian movements. For 40 years, we have been raising the alarm about threats to democracy and partnering directly with frontline groups to develop strategy and build movement alignment to fight back. Our role is to not only understand the threats that we are seeing, but also to understand where our movements can build power so that we can change the outcome. And as you know all too well, we are now in a generational fight for democratic possibility in this country. The US right and major sectors of the ruling class have largely coalesced into a MAGA bloc that has captured the Supreme Court, the executive branch, both houses of Congress, and nearly half of state governments. We have seen authoritarianism ebb and flow throughout our history here in the US, often in the form of white supremacy or white Christian supremacy. And we have seen a significant acceleration over the past decade, mirroring global trends. And the past few months, the first 100 days of Trump's second presidency have been an overwhelming escalation with increased state violence and attacks on our most vulnerable communities and on our institutions, civil society, and rule of law. Today's webinar will focus in on attacks on immigrants, Muslim and Arab communities, student activists, and the Palestinian Solidarity Movement. We will attempt to contextualize the regime's agenda, the current regime's agenda, within a broader authoritarian playbook. We're working hard with movement partners to identify our leverage points and opportunities to block authoritarian capture. Regardless, I do know that to make progress, we need an unprecedented level of coordination and cross-movement coalition building. And PRA feels an immense responsibility to help support movement organizations to understand and leverage the power that we have and help build the people power that we need to move us through this period and towards our vision of a multiracial feminist democracy. So again, thank you so much, everyone, for being here today. And we're grateful to be in the struggle with you. And I'll hand it back to Naomi to introduce our speakers.
I am Naomi Washington Leapart. I am the Strategic Partnerships Director at PRA. And I'll be kind of moving us through this conversation. And so let me tell you who you're going to hear insights from on the PRA team. We're going to hear from Stephen Gardner, who is Principal Research Advisor at PRA. Stephen has been researching, writing, and strategizing in opposition to the politics of bigotry, violence, and authoritarianism since the early 1990s. And in his work at PRA, Stephen helps frontline movements strategize to fight the right. And Stephen helps to shape PRA's analysis and strategy. We'll also hear from, who is a research analyst at PRA, has written extensively on intergenerational political repression on historically marginalized communities in the United States, Arab American diasporic politics, U.S. foreign policy on the Middle East, and Islamophobia and anti-Arab bigotry in American policy and law. At PRA, monitors legislation and discourses addressing terrorism, extremism, Islamophobia, and anti-Arab racism, and also the expanding, the ever-expanding security state. And then we'll hear from Ethan Foray, who is also a senior research analyst at PRA. Ethan has over a decade of experience researching the anti-immigrant and white nationalist movements, They work closely with other researchers, journalists, national organizations, and grassroots activists to deepen their understanding of anti-immigrant, anti-Muslim, and white nationalist movements. So, first to the mic is Stephen Gardner, who's going to be talking about the decline of democracy and the constitutional crisis facing us in this moment. Stephen?
Thank you, Naomi. So I'm going to frame up some of the issues that we're looking at, throw in a few examples, and speak a little bit to what I see as some, in general, broad terms, what are some key responses that we need to be making. So first of all, I'm a firm believer that you can't win a fight you don't know you're in. And the first recognition that we have to have is that the situation is not normal. The first 100 days of the second Trump regime is not normal by the standards of modern presidencies in the United States. It's fairly normal by the standards of want-to-be authoritarian regimes historically and in the contemporary world from around the world. Now, of course, it's true that, you know, we live under entrenched regimes of white supremacy and of patriarchy and of settler colonialism and of racial capitalism. And this is an ongoing reality. But we have to recognize that the situation now is that the people who are currently in the White House and who are most informing it are part of movements or beholden to movements or celebrated by movements that think that we live in a country that's not racist enough, not hierarchical enough, not sexist enough, and not racist enough, not classist enough. We are in that moment. Now, it's also true that power has been increasingly concentrated. Government power has been increasingly concentrated in the executive branch for a century. It's been on the increase. However, yes, I mean, this is in some ways business as usual. I mean, you can look back and see since 9/11, the ways in which presidential power to declare someone an enemy combatant, and even if they're American resident, and detain them indefinitely without trial. The use of so-called enhanced interrogation methods, meaning torture on people who've been convicted of no crime because of the category that they get put in. The use of drone attacks, drone assassination attacks, regardless of potential murder of civilians in the process. And all of this is taken pretty much as business as usual at this point. The difference with the Trump 2 regime from this ordinary concentration of presidential power is that the Bush, the Obama, the Clinton, going back to the Reagan administration at least, their efforts to concentrate power in the executive have been, however grudgingly at moments, endorsed by the courts and or by Congress. And there has been at least some effort to bring the public along with whatever policies were in mind, or to keep those policies secret from the public if there was an understanding that the public could not be relied upon to support them. The Trump 2 regime doesn't seem to have any interest in having the support of Congress or of the federal courts or even of the people, apart from placating some of its base and bringing in a coterie of billionaires using a combination of bribes and intimidation. This is a drastic change, even if it seems remote. The U.S. constitutional system is not designed to work unless the various branches of government are jealous of their own authority. They have to protect it aggressively from other branches. And failing to do so, either through being intimidated or through being seduced by the dark side, or for whatever other reason, because they think that the future of democracy, there is no future for democracy, so they might as well get on board. This leads to the situation that we're in, where you have a regime that is informed by some of the most violent, reactionary, bigoted, and hierarchical elements of social movements that we have seen in this country. And this is who is whispering to the president, and he is, for the most part, listening. All right, that's sort of at the general level. So here's some examples of this stamping on institutional power of other institutions and getting away with it for the most part so far. But I will also point out where the pushback is and where we need to be thinking about what we can do. So disregard for congressional authority over the key power of Congress is in the budget, in spending and appropriation and taxation, power of the purse, as it's called. The Trump regime has declared its authority to basically decimate congressionally mandated programs and departments and agencies, either directly through massive layoffs or through making decisions that make it impossible for those organizations to function as they were intended, as they were written into law, or by appointing incompetent and loyalty above all directors and top-level managers, and firing anyone who might disagree. And then, of course, the entire tariff regime designed, the president has some congressional authority, some constitutional authority to use tariffs on an emergency basis if the country were, for example, in some kind of deep economic crisis. This is quite the contrary of all legal basis here. And the challenges will be there, but who knows how long it will take to roll those challenges out. Ignoring basic constitutional rights. I mean, we take a lot of this for granted or understand that it has never applied equally across the board. But nonetheless, we see principles, basic principles like free speech, where time and time again, it has been ruled by Supreme Court and it's established law that whether you are a citizen or a resident, if you are subject to the jurisdiction of the United States, if you're inside the territory and its laws apply to you, you have ability, you have freedom to speak, even if your speech is politically disagreeable to the powers that be. Now we see people being deported, having their residency statuses revoked, and not just being deported, being kidnapped without due process and sent to parts of the country that are more amenable to the regime because the judges there have been appointed by Trump or indicated that they're in other ways loyal to Trump, or even sent out of the country on little or no due process by invocation of the Alien Enemies Act. Again, Alien Enemies Act is a centuries-old law that has never been used for anything but shaky purposes. And in the moment, it's used to name gang members, quote unquote, without any due process, on simply on the claim of the Justice Department or Department of Homeland Security that they are suspected gang members, and thereby, regardless of how they entered the country in the first place, rounded up, blindfolded, put into chains or zip tied, put on a plane and sent to a detention center in a third country in El Salvador. This is par the course for an authoritarian regime who wants to designate enemies, try to make people feel afraid and show that they have the capacity to basically do this kind of extrajudicial violence against almost anyone they want. Then we have executive attacks on trans people, executive orders attacks on trans people, for example, serving in the military on the grounds that they're trans, nothing else, basically denying their humanity. An action described by the judge who issued the initial temporary restraining order as soaked in animus. The executive order and the policy declaration from the Department of Defense soaked in animus. You almost never see language like that from a judge when ruling about the government. And then in the last few days, the Supreme Court has declined to allow that restraining order to remain in effect on the grounds that we don't know how it will come out in the end. So this is not on the merits of the case. Basically, with the merits of the case, it pits presidential authority as commander-in-chief over the military to do basically whatever he wants against the basic humanity of trans people, so their basic rights to due process and equal protection. That is a question that would have to be argued in the courts and could take months or years. In the meantime, the Supreme Court says, no, go ahead and enforce that ban, and that this will essentially end the careers of people who are caught up in it. The use of executive power to target and intimidate private entities that have broken no laws and are, in fact, engaging in constitutionally protected activities, often the kinds of activities, political speech, that is seen as the most protected, or engaging in public interest law that is defending other people's right to due process. So these are some of the most historically rulings have been consistent that these are the most protected of rights, and they're basically being ignored by the Trump administration, who alternatively uses executive orders or random declarations on social media to vilify and call for targeting by the Justice Department or the Department of Homeland Security or the Secretary of State, target these people for deportation, for decertification, or removal of their nonprofit status, for criminal investigation, for tax investigation, for whatever they can possibly trump up. And then we have what else? I mean, I could go on almost indefinitely, but the declaration by Trump, I mean, what he says he's doing, he who saves his country, he does write this on social media, he who saves his country does not violate any law. So he's claiming not just immunity, but a kind of sovereignty associated with absolute dictators or absolute monarchs. I wanted to say a few more things here. Is this a constitutional crisis? From my point of view, this is a lot like the question, is it fascism yet? Or is this an authoritarian regime? And the answer, as I see it, is we're not well served by a binary yes or no. There is a constitutional crisis brewing. We are far down the road to the attempt to create authoritarianism, even with some fascistic tendencies. But where we land depends on what kind of resistance we can create. And for that, I'm going to just name a couple of things. Where we see noncompliance and public refusal, we need to support that. Even if it's coming from people whom we would not think of as our primary allies, we support it by being public about supporting noncompliance. When we see people who are complying, particularly in institutional power, we need to forcefully remind them that historically, people who go along with authoritarian violence in particular are not treated well under principles of law, under reconciliation, under the Nuremberg principles that obeying orders is not an excuse if those orders are transparently illegal, and particularly when lives and freedom are at stake. And we need to be ready to work with people who are quite likely to be increasingly mobilized around the crises in economics, damage to healthcare, to necessary institutions and protections in the environment and education and in infrastructure that are unfolding, not in slow motion, but as fast as they can be made to happen in front of our eyes. There is going to be a backlash, and we in movement land need to be thinking about how do we prevent the most vulnerable from being excluded from, targeted, or taken advantage of, even while we provide some values and moral clarity to the movements that emerge, and figuring out how we can have the most strategic influence possible.
Wow. Thank you so much, Stephen, for laying out that extraordinarily complex situation with such clarity. We will bring next to the mic, who will talk about political repression and anti-Muslim targeting.
So prior to Trump coming into office the second time, he and his allies had been telling us what policies and laws they would enact through plans like Agenda 47, which is a set of campaign promises that Trump campaign made to his base, and the Heritage Foundation's Project 2025. One observation about these policy agendas was that they did not mention religious minorities. There are passive remarks about Islamic terror and Islamist extremism, but there is no mention of Muslims as a community. This omission perpetuates the so-called Judeo-Christian hegemony that already exists within the US, excessively entangling religion in the state and threatening religious plurality. Based on the administration's past actions in its first 100 days, it's clear that we need to take a hard look at its underlying motives. The US today is far from a model of democracy or religious pluralism, especially given the administration's past Islamophobic policies, which have been shaped in collaboration with a coalition of far-right, religiously conservative, anti-immigrant, and pro-war groups. Some communities already live in an Agenda 47, Project 2025 world. especially racial and religious minorities, particularly Arabs and Muslims, LGBTQ individuals, and progressive political dissidents. What's different about this current moment is how enthusiastically the state pursues policies that embody collective punishment and how unconstitutional these policies are. Today, I'll be showing you a few of the most important policies from this admin's first 100 days and their implications. While we had an idea of what the second admin would look like, we do have a few surprises. For instance, we don't have a blatantly anti-Muslim travel ban in effect, yet at least. This is most likely due to the previous ban's inability to withstand legal scrutiny, and it was constantly being challenged and struck down by the courts. Not only was the Muslim ban landmark legislation, it was also a key promise to his base, especially in light of the genocide in Gaza and escalating violence in the Middle East and increased anti-Arab and anti-Muslim rhetoric socially and politically. So not having it within the first 100 days is somewhat surprising. What we do have, however, is Executive Order 14161, protecting the United States from foreign terrorists and other national security and public safety threats, which lawyers and activists have named the Muslim Ban 2.0. Specifically, this executive order proclaims that, and I am directly quoting the order here, the United States must ensure that admitted aliens and aliens otherwise already present in the United States do not bear hostile attitudes towards citizens, culture, government institutions, or founding principles, and do not advocate for, aid, or support designated foreign terrorists and other threats to our national security. This executive order was introduced on January 20th, so day one, and requires the Secretary of State, the Attorney General, the Secretary of Homeland Security, and the National Security Advisory, and the Director of National Intelligence to submit a list of countries whose citizens can't be screened or vetted enough that they may pose a threat to the national security, which justifies a full or partial suspension of admission for these nationals through U.S. borders. While this executive order hasn't been implemented yet, there was a leak to the New York Times about how this will roll out. Facially, this executive order seems neutral and doesn't discriminate against any group of specific people. The tiered ranking system is specifically designed to evade judicial scrutiny around religious discrimination by including many other non-Muslim majority countries. However, this executive order doesn't emerge from a vacuum. Not only does it have a similar name to the original ban, it comes after the administration's previous statements about universities turning students into savages and jihadists that want to destroy Israel, the United States, and Western civilization. And the racialized language about terrorists and terrorism is conflated with Arabs and Muslims. This executive order was meant to specifically target those traditionally targeted in the war on terror, and more recently, the neo-McCarthyist repression of pro-Palestine activists. It assumes the base of pro-Palestine advocacy are foreigners, especially those from Middle Eastern or Muslim majority countries. But the mistake is that while this movement is transnational, it is mostly homegrown. It also turns dissent to foreign policy and national security concern, something we have seen in previous administration, especially when it comes to the Palestine Solidarity Movement. We have seen how this executive order may be enforced with the case of pro-Palestine student activists, especially those of Middle Eastern and Muslim descent. Five students have been stalked and abducted by ICE agents. Mohsen hid in his apartment for 3 weeks out of fear of being abducted for his pro-Palestine activism, only to be detained by ICE agents at USCIS citizenship appointment. Two students, Leka Kordia and Ali Raza Daroudi, claim they have no ties to any political movements and that they were targeted based on their ethnic identity. Most famously, Mahmoud Khalil, a recent graduate of Columbia University, was abducted by plainclothes ICE agents outside his apartment while he was with his pregnant wife, and Rumeysa Öztürk, a Turkish PhD student at Tufts, who was abducted a few streets away from PRA's office in Somerville by masked plainclothes ICE agents for simply co-authoring a letter asking Tufts to divest. These students have been labeled as lunatics by Secretary of State Marco Rubio, who has a lengthy history of Islamophobic and racist policies. More recently, he has been getting closer to Christian Zionist organizations to align himself with the admin's inner circle, so his statements aren't a surprise. But what's surprising to hear is the Secretary of State themselves boasting about revoking visas. Even more shocking is how involved the federal government is in personally exacting violence onto students and immigrants. Islamic counterterrorism policies have been in place since the 1970s, laying the groundwork for the patterns we're seeing today, especially the patterns of surveillance and repression. What we're seeing now is normalization and acceleration of policies and frameworks that have received bipartisan support. The admin is actually collaborating or talking with foreign governments to potentially deport unwanted populations and dissidents, including citizens. And most obviously, this is part of a larger crackdown on immigration. This is somewhat outdated data because this was retrieved yesterday morning. But every day, hundreds of people are being disappeared by the deportation machine based on their ethnic and racial background. Now I want to turn to policies from the first 100 days that target political dissidents and enhance political repression more broadly, yet disproportionately target communities and movements at the center of the global war on terror. There are H.R. 9495 and H.R. 6408, commonly known as the nonprofit killer bills, which are still on the table to be passed by Congress or executive order. These bills would give the federal government unilateral power to declare nonprofits as terrorist supporting organizations, revoke their nonprofit status, and seize their assets. We immediately think of think tanks and charities, but universities, schools, religious centers, community centers are also nonprofits and are at risk, especially those for Muslims, Arabs, South Asians, and immigrants. There is also the Anti-Semitism Awareness Act, which would adopt the IRA definition of anti-Semitism, which equates anti-Zionism with anti-Semitism as law. This law has been proposed other times, but it ultimately doesn't pass. It may pass now, since there is an executive order on additional measures to combat anti-Semitism. This coordinated attack on pro-Palestine advocacy would chill speech, especially around foreign policy. There is also Project ESSER, which is the official Heritage Foundation name for the program. This admin is already implementing it by deporting pro-Palestine students. But it has existed as some sort of covert policy for decades in the form of Operation Boulder or the Patriot Act. And finally, there are ICE abductions and visa revocations. The State Department has reportedly stopped revoking visas and in some cases reinstate visas. However, there are suspicions of a more violent policy possibly being implemented. There are also rumors that universities asked admin to slow down on visa revocations since it made international students anxious of applying or attending universities in the United States. And international students are an essential economic lifeline for some universities. Islamophobia, anti-Arab, and anti-immigrant racism, and the criminalization of pro-Palestine activism and solidarity, and the expanding security state did not start in the past 100 days. They have only become more visible. At PRA, we mostly talk about the block and build strategy, and the movement is mostly in block mode. Most of the visible resistance is happening in courtrooms, blocking the harm of these policies. Lawyers have been working tirelessly to defend students, activists, and incarcerated immigrants from repressive policies that also physically endanger communities. An important part of our strategy will be considering how to support legal defense efforts, whether financially, by providing research support, or physically showing up. While movement lawyers play a specific role in blocking authoritarianism, they cannot do it alone. Social movements have been working on building more resilient movements to not only withstand another 4 years, but to also emerge stronger by utilizing the unique historical, social, and economic conditions we're experiencing to build a better world. And with that, I'm going to give it back to Naomi and Ethan. Thank you, everyone.
Wow. Thank you for making it plain, right? And centering the ones who have been vulnerable to this repression and these kind of disappearances. Next to the mic, we bring Ethan Foray, who is going to talk to us even further about these mass deportations and strategic responses to this effort. Ethan?
Thank you very much, Naomi, and my other colleagues here on this call today. I'm always so impressed with their knowledge and clarity, and they're a tough act to follow, but I'm going to try my best here. For decades, you know, the expansion of the deportation machine and immigration enforcement apparatus has been a bipartisan project. These first 100 days are pretty exceptional, though, and we've seen a dramatic escalation of enforcement activity and perhaps the clearest realization yet of the so-called attrition through enforcement strategy that was first articulated by leaders of the anti-immigrant movement in the mid-aughts. This movement is driven by white nationalist goals to drastically reduce all forms of immigration and has seen its influence ebb and flow across party lines over the last 40 years. But it's undeniable that both Trump administrations have wholly embraced its personnel and policy goals, creating a high watermark, frankly, for the anti-immigrant movement's influence in this country. And we're going to talk a little bit about how that's materializing now. As Stephen both mentioned, you know, this strategy has inspired the administration to invoke centuries-old laws like the Alien Enemies Act, in addition to Cold War-era ideological exclusion, and also many post-9/11 so-called anti-terrorism policies that are functionally eliminating due process rights. And I think the most kind of brazen example of this we've seen, as Stephen mentioned already, is these hundreds of people that have been renditioned to a notorious prison in El Salvador. This includes many authorized to reside in the U.S. that, as courts have even ruled, like one of the most high-profile instances being Kamara Braga Garcia. And these actions build on previous decades' efforts to exclude people, including alleged communists and terrorists, under the guise of national security. But they're also a prelude for a broader authoritarian power grab. In the midst of so much of this, we've seen administration officials threaten to include U.S. citizens or so-called homegrowns in future rendition campaigns. This escalation crucially goes beyond renditions and anticipated increases in like street level enforcement activity that many anticipated, but we're seeing much more as well, kind of being dragged into this targeting, including many political dissidents. As noted, Palestinian solidarity activists has been at the forefront of this targeting. That's undeniable. But we're seeing it expanded as well to many community and also increasingly during worksite enforcement actions, labor leaders. So it's clearly an effort not just to crack down on Palestine solidarity, but also many other vehicles for justice in our communities as well. This is being paired with other things like further scrutiny at airports and additional enforcement at previously deemed sensitive locations, including houses of worship and courthouses. One of the early executive orders eliminated guidance that prohibited enforcement actions at many of these locations, including courthouses. In fact, on day one, there were 10 such orders signed that revived 27 policies from the previous Trump administration and also enacted more than half a dozen more. This was an action that ProPublica described as 4 years in a day. And these orders set off a flurry of legal challenges that could take months or even years to resolve in courts, exacerbates already deeply felt feelings of uncertainty and precarity in communities. And ICE is leveraging that precarity. So despite the fact that judges are already beginning to rule in, rule on some of these policy changes, but none of these are truly set in stone as they go through appeals processes and things like that, ICE itself is unwavering in its brazen ignoring of these laws. Right-wing media's ceaselessly targeting judges for harassment has only exacerbated this, and I don't want to say it's culminated, but it's certainly escalated to a degree recently, where last month we saw the FBI arrest a judge in Wisconsin for allegedly obstructing ICE enforcement. These actions are a clear effort to intimidate and delegitimize any member of the judiciary already disproportionately altered in favor of the Trump administration during its first regime, seeking to rein in the executive branch's authoritarian abuses of power and unconstitutional actions. Again, some of these tensions and competitions among the branches of government that Stephen elucidated earlier. One of the more concerning and likely long-lasting developments that we've seen in this first 100 days is the rapid expansion of local law enforcement's cooperation agreements with ICE via the 287G program. This is one of the key components of the anti-immigrant movement's attrition strategy. It deputizes local law enforcement, allowing them to carry out federal immigration enforcement actions. And this program has exploded since January with nearly 450 new or updated agreements, primarily in the U.S. South, where many residents and a significant portion of local law enforcement has been primed by years of anti-immigrant fear-mongering and scapegoating and are eager to weaponize the state against immigrants and immigrant communities. This graph here was produced last month by a great researcher, Austin Kocher, and it's already out of date, similar trend to what I was talking about. I looked this morning, and instead of the 444 total agreements this chart shows, there's over 520 now and another 110 pending. So this is a tremendous increase. In fact, during 1 week in February, there were more new agreements signed than there had been in all of previous existence at a single time. So this is a tremendous expansion, and we're only 100 days into this. And we can see that, again, the fact that there are over 100 already pending agreements as well, that shows that this trend is not showing any sign of stopping. And with these agreements, ICE is expanding its reach into communities at a scale that we haven't seen since the agency was created in 2003. Even more troubling than just the sheer number of these agreements is what has changed. A significant number of these agreements are now under a newly revived version of the 287G program known as the Task Force model. While other variants of 287G isolate enforcement activity primarily to local jails and correction facilities, the Task Force model allows local police to engage in immigration enforcement actions while doing routine patrols out on the streets. This is a model that gained notoriety during the George W. Bush and Obama administrations, and it garnered significant criticism and legal challenge for enabling discriminatory enforcement activity. This was found to be true, and ultimately it was suspended in 2012. But the resurrection of it portends some truly, truly troubling activity ahead of time. And there are some states that are taking a lead at trying to be at the vanguard of this effort. One of them, most notably, I believe, is the state of Florida, which is, you know, really positioning itself to be the kind of the face of this expanded local cooperation effort. While the vast majority of 287G agreements in the past have been limited to sheriff's departments and other correctional facilities, Florida and some other states, but particularly Florida at this moment, has expanded the use of the program to include other law enforcement entities, including the Highway Patrol and the National Guard, and even the Fish and Wildlife Service and the State Lottery Commission. As of last Friday, 173 of the 242 task force model agreements that have been signed since January were in Florida. And last week, Governor DeSantis touted the results of Operation Tidal Wave, it was called, and described as a first-of-its-kind partnership that resulted in the arrest of over 1,100 people. It's important to recognize that this is being enabled by the 287G program itself, which didn't exist until 1996, before a law that was written by the anti-immigrant movement, primarily the anti-immigrant group, the Federation for American Immigration Reform, and ultimately signed into law by President Clinton. This was a significant expansion of enforcement authority, but followed nearly a century of laws that linked our civil immigration system and the criminal legal system. This enforcement apparatus, already massive, is getting larger, with Congress likely to vote billions more in taxpayer funds for additional detention facilities and other resources for ICE and Border Patrol. They've already granted additional things, and the pending continuing resolution that's being considered right now, I believe, is, at the last time I checked, going to provide an additional $45 billion for ICE itself. So it's in this moment that it's vital we support legal defense efforts for those ensnared in the rapidly growing deportation machine, as well as the work to both defend and strengthen sanctuary policies across the country that seek to shield residents from overzealous enforcement and 287G expansion. Much like what was saying, so much of this is occurring in the courts right now, but at the same time, we need to be cognizant of the fact that there's tremendous work happening in communities, whether it's mutual aid networks, political education work, and Know Your Rights campaigns, materials, these types of things. All of this work needs to be defended and supported. At the same time, we must imagine and work towards a future where these distinct immigration and criminal legal systems are no longer entwined. For as long as these two are paired, immigration enforcement will be a key component of authoritarian strategy and its consolidation of power. For decades, immigrant rights movements have led the way and successfully fought back against the deportation machine. The mass marches we saw across the country on May Day reaffirmed these movements' scale and power. We must reaffirm our support and commitment to their vision, that this system desperately needs to reflect reality, that no human being is legal. It nearly did before we were born and must be realized now.
Wow. Thank you so much, Ethan and Stephen. You all have shared, each of you have shared the strategic orientation we need to have in this time, or a few strategic actions or considerations we need to have in this time. Could you speak even more broadly to what you think can stave off kind of inertia and despair and just, you know, a feeling of helplessness given the onslaught that we've experienced in just these first 100 days? What do you advise people to do to transform their kind of rage or their grief or their feeling of helplessness into meaningful action. Just what are your personal and maybe even professional takes on that?
I think the first thing is to not let grief harden into despair. And the key to, or an important key to avoiding that, is recognizing the grief, acknowledging it, feeling it. But then I say to myself, I can't do this by myself. I've got to reach out to my people. And I've got to talk to my people about, one, what can we do? And two, who else should we be connected to? Or who are we already connected to that we need to spread out that work? And then we have to do something. And that something doesn't have to be the heroic thing. But if we see people doing heroic things, we need to support it. And if we see people who are in trouble, we need to help. So the action, the movement towards the acknowledging the grief, and then the movement toward action. So we get with our other justice-minded people of goodwill, and we go for it. Whatever level is in accord with what we can do, we have to ask ourselves what's reasonable for us. But we have to come with the attitude that this is not a fight that's going to be over tomorrow or the next day. This is an ongoing fight. And even if we win the part where this regime goes away, the damage that has been done just in the last 100 days, added on to the damage that was done the last 400 years, it's going to take time and effort to repair and transcend. Never stop fighting, but be smart, pick your battles, and don't do it alone.
I love this notion of community as the antidote to despair. Regimes want to isolate us. That's one of their strategies. Let's turn to some of the questions, some really great questions that our attendees have raised. A couple around the anti-immigrant movements. Someone suggested that Trump 2.0 didn't announce a second Muslim ban because they were worried it would spur widespread mobilizing and organizing like we saw under Trump 1. What role might widespread mobilizations play in resisting authoritarianism? Do you think the Trump administration is afraid of this? What can we learn from the way our resistance movements in Trump 1 put pressure on and ultimately soured kind of public perspective on the Muslim ban then?
I think one thing we can think about is how resistance to the first ban was. So resistance to the second ban is going to look very different than how resistance to the first ban was. And while the administration may be afraid about a widespread mobilization across the country, especially at airports, I think movements and the public are very different than a 2016 public. For instance, the rise of political repression since October 7th, especially on campuses, airports, universities, has jaded the movement. So I don't think people have that courage or even the ability to participate in that widespread movement anymore. I don't think they can do that, and not to mention we're currently facing a recession and people are incentivized by survival. We also just experienced a pandemic, so people aren't in their perfect health. So life looks very different now. Would there be another mass mobilization if there was another ban? Probably, but it wouldn't be as big as the initial one.
Gotcha. Thank you. Is there any truth to the rumor that private citizens are being deputized? We talked about law enforcement cooperating with ICE. What about private citizens being deputized to detain people on behalf of ICE? Any truth to that? Do you think that's coming?
That's a strategy that has been discussed in the far right for decades. And it was also the motivation that in the early and mid-aughts fueled the vigilante movements like the Minutemen along the U.S.-Mexico border. But in terms of that type of like vigilante mobilization or that coupling with the state enforcement apparatus, while in some instances I believe that kind of position or deputization can be done, I don't believe it's being done in any like meaningful sense right now, but partially because they don't need to. Local law enforcement feels so compelled, as we saw with this rapid rise of 287G already, that this is a component, but there's already so much of a rapid expansion that I think everyone is still trying to level set and see where and what this new enforcement can look like. So it's not to say that it's, you know, can or should be ruled out. As it's happened in the first 100 days, I don't believe it's happened in any significant way.
I just want to go back to what Stephen and Ethan were saying. First and foremost, there is an anonymous tip line. So if you know someone or someone you know knows someone undocumented, you can call the tip line. When that tool was first mobilized by DHS and ICE, people were spamming it. But the fact that anyone can report anyone because the state gives people the ability to report on people. And not to mention this comes with mass surveillance and social surveillance capacity, which is normalized. That being said, there are organizations that have been working or collaborating with law enforcement to detain and deport people, especially those who are on visas, specifically student visas. For instance, at a State Department briefing, the Secretary of State refused to acknowledge whether the government was working in collaboration with Batar, a far-right Zionist organization, which profiles pro-Palestine students and reports them to DHS to then possibly deport them. Batar says they are working with law enforcement, but law enforcement refuses to acknowledge whether or not they do work with Batar. So while it might not be private citizens, it could be a private citizen, and private citizens do have the power to report and surveil undocumented immigrants, pro-Palestine activists. It's pretty grim, but it's pretty normalized in the past 2 decades.
Where are you seeing the most leverageable cracks in the right-wing coalition? So we are sort of right-sizing the threat, understanding the threat more deeply. Where are their possibilities for us?
Well, I mean, the one that became obvious a few weeks ago, early on after the inauguration, was between Musk and the neo-reactionaries, particularly those in engineering and software development and AI, and the ethno-nationalists, who were particularly represented in this case by Steve Bannon, who's, of course, not in the administration, but remains sort of the godfather of the ethno-nationalist wing of influencers. Around H-1B visas, which are given to people with technical skills, to tech industry mostly, but other high-level engineering and technically important, scientifically important work in the United States. It's a whole category of visa for folk, often from South Asia, East Asia, from anywhere technically, a specialized category of visa that people can get. And of course, the ethno-nationalist movement said, well, wait, why are we giving away these great jobs to these foreigners, read people of color, when they could be done by Americans, read white people. And so this is one wedge in the thing. And it's like hard to know what side to be on in this, but if they can argue with each other, they're at least wasting each other's time.
Yeah, I would just quickly add two things going off what Stephen said. I do believe that, you know, there are some wedge opportunities, particularly in the, you know, that kind of like techno-feudalist camp and, you know, more libertarian-minded area, particularly as it relates to these systems of mass surveillance that both already exist but are currently being developed as well, particularly right now around the immigration content. We're seeing Palantir receive, I believe, $30, $35 million to develop this new surveillance platform that ICE is going to be utilizing. But as, you know, we've been talking about, the long history of all of these tools and platforms is that they eventually come around and are being leveraged both against people with authorized status, but eventually U.S. citizens as well. And I believe that there are concerns that can be leveraged there. But just another quick dimension to the H-1B visa guest worker programs thing that Stephen mentioned is that another component is that there are many other countries and folks who have a vested interest in the maintenance of those types of visa programs. And as you know, there is kind of an emerging thing around this kind of like right wing international that is hitting a lot of impediments for things like this, because someone like India's Narendra Modi would love if these visas going on soon, and if they do get that, but then all of a sudden his country is also getting hit with tariffs for this or that, these seemingly arbitrary things, and exacerbating those types of tensions to eliminate some additional unity for these foreign countries, across the globe to be able to enact this common goal or, agenda is certainly another component there. And, you got to kind of widen the aperture a bit more there to talk about this. But I believe those are some other tensions as we talk about how we can divide the right at the moment.
I wanted to add to Ethan's point. So just recently in Texas, in a little Republican town, they were doing an audit of their taxes and they discovered that $4 million of their tax dollars went to Israel. So they decided that instead of sending $4 million to Israel, they wanted to keep that $4 million and reinvest it back into the community. And they immediately got a letter from the governor, Governor Greg Abbott, calling them anti-Semites. So there is a rupture within the right, even within the conservative bloc. And if you're looking at the bloc and build strategy, community infrastructure in the United States is a really good way of divesting from the war machine and the deportation machine, whether it's by collaborating on budgets, whether it's by appropriation bills or participating in town halls. Redirecting that money that would generally go to Israel, a genocidal foreign government, into communities is going to be a really effective method at dismantling this big authoritarian regime.
Let's hang right here for a moment. I mean, there have been some questions about what can we do? What can local communities do? What should state governments be doing? What do grassroots nonprofits need to be doing? Can you talk maybe in broad terms about categories of action, categories of resistance, recognizing that each context is going to, as you said, you know, do it a little differently. Are there some broad categories that we should be considering? Strikes, boycotts? What do you all think about that?
I want to emphasize that I am not a lawyer, so anything I say is not legal advice. There are a couple of things that we can do. For instance, just recently Harvard sued the Trump administration because of the way the administration is coming after their nonprofit status. And one of their arguments is that we're not anti-Semitic because we actually repress the pro-Palestine movement very well. And if we're looking individually, like if I were to give advice to Harvard, I would say, yeah, go ahead. Keep suing the government. Go ahead. But if I were to look at student activists, faculty, students, people who aren't even activists, people who are just vulnerable on that campus, I would tell them very different advice. For instance, nonviolence, noncompliance is a very effective tool to disrupting repressive policies. Not to mention, counter-narrative work has been very effective in changing people's minds and ideas about things. We are learning from a lot of studies about how there's a national shift on ideas about racial justice, U.S. support for Israel, and other authoritarian states. People's opinions about religion, economic justice, gender rules, and all these things are changing. Us, people in nonprofit and the social justice movement space, have a very unique role in that we're able to move directly with these people to be able to produce counter-narratives and very unique and special research to help activists, lawyers, and legal advocates. Some of us are even uniquely positioned to speak directly to elected officials. So everything has a time and a place. We do have another election cycle next year, so some of us are going to have to go into the field to mobilize people. And until then, and I'm saying this from where I am, I do a lot of counter-narrative work. We do research and analysis on how these rules uniquely affect people's lives. And then we talk to people who work directly with these communities to help change those policies and people's individual and everyday practices and strategies.
Yeah, in some ways, I think as a lot of us are saying, is that a lot of this stuff isn't necessarily new. In escalation, absolutely, but it's not new to a degree. And there are some, you know, tried and true ways to respond to so much of this stuff. You know, we mentioned things, you know, as it relates to immigration particularly, we've talked about, you know, sanctuary policies as a form of, you know, non-cooperation or non-compliance. And while imperfect as those policies may be, the reason they're continually demonized by the administration is because they are a legitimate obstacle toward their agenda. Recognizing that there is additional pressure that's going to be coming from the federal government towards those jurisdictions, largely probably going to be focusing on the use of allocation of federal funds, for example, that those states and localities receive. We need to be working with our local leaders at, you know, at all levels, your city councilors to your governor and, you know, all the state lawmakers in between to be steadfast and hold to, you know, the values that, you know, these states have adopted and recognize that if elections go and if the work is done to make sure that it happens, the electoral landscape will be a little different, not too long from now. You know, still it's a long road ahead, but it's not insurmountable and we can definitely traverse it.
There's an attendee that has asked specifically Sylvia and to talk about what's inspiring you right now in our fight for justice. What's inspiring you?
Thanks, Naomi, and thanks for that question. Yeah, I live in Boston. I am really inspired by the work that is happening to join together to stop deportations, the Mutual Aid Immigration Justice Hotline, LUCID. I also continue to be really inspired by the courage of the student movement against genocide across the country right now. And another story that I find really inspiring that folks may have heard about is how over 1,000 people came together to protest deportation of a local family in Sackett's Harbor, New York. Folks may have heard the story. A mother and her 3 school-aged kids were arrested and put in detention. This is a town that only has a recorded population of, I think, 1,351 people. And there were 1,000 people counted or reported, you know, reported as turning out to a rally. This is rated as the most reliably Republican district in the state of New York. And it's a place where borders are. Tom Homan happens to have a vacation home. And so, and they were released as a result. It was incredible victory. And I think if we can truly come together and build the united front that's needed and really think strategically about how we're moving in this moment, we can create beautiful possibilities. So I'm holding on to those hopeful examples. I'll pass it to you.
Thank you. I'm not from here. I'm Arab. And for almost a year and a half, I have watched people who look like me experience unspeakable things. People who speak my language, who look like me, who have my name. I am moved by how they are able to find joy every day, how they are so persistent every day, and how they experience authoritarian conditions worse than I do. I have family overseas, and I see how much they love life and how much they have hope. And they work towards wanting a better life for themselves, their kids, and for their futures. And I have so much privilege, and I am inspired by how persistent they are to have a good life, not only for themselves, but for the whole world. And that inspires me to keep doing my work. I may be 3, 4, 5,000 miles away from home, but I am so inspired by them. And I see how people, especially on campuses, young people who have never been to the Middle East, the Arab world, just stand up for injustice, putting everything on their on the line, their futures, even their academic work, their professional possibilities, everything. That inspires me and it motivates me so much.
You know, I'm a preacher, and that was a hell of a sermon close. Thank you so much for reminding us that hope is our responsibility, right? As a discipline that we practice every day. I want to say thank you to our wonderful researchers, our executive director, our comms folks who are behind the scenes making the magic happen in terms of the technical support, and the entire PRA team and board for keeping us informed, keeping our resistance informed. Stay connected to PRA, and you will always get a timely and relevant analysis about what's going on. Thank you so much, everybody. Let's keep resisting. Let's keep resisting.
Thank you for listening to Inform Your Resistance with PRA. Today's episode was hosted by me, Koki Mendes. The podcast is produced by Olivia Lawrence Wildman. Jack Gieskind created our show notes and Frank Lawrence our music. Fact checking by Abigail Battles. Sound design and mixing by Thick Skin Media. If you haven't already, rate, review, and subscribe. If you appreciate our work, please consider donating to Political Research Associates at politicalresearch.org. And the best thing you can do to help us is tell your comrades about the pod. Resisting authoritarianism is better with friends. Until next time.